حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل، نعم المولى ونعم النصير. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله الحكيم في كتابه المتين، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، ولقد كان لكم في رسول الله أسوة حسنة. صلوات على محمد. After the break of Muharram and Safar, inshallah, we get back to our subject of the Seerat of the Prophet that has been ongoing for the last 2 years. And just the discussion that we were having is about the life of the Prophet. And before I just go into the details, just why the Seerat is so important again for us as we are going to begin a new chapter in his life. Why is the Seerat so important? What does it make us do? You see, Seerat is not history. History is the analysis of events that happen and looking at them, trying to understand them. It is different than Seerat. Seerat of the Prophet, when we speak about that, what it means is that in the events of the history, what did the Prophet do? How did he react? How did he perform? What decisions did he make? These are the things that to us are important, because the fact is, when we want to have faith in Islam and truly increase our belief, you see, there's nothing that helps us more than the Seerat of the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt. If you'll see that a lot of children have a hard time praying, and if parents want them to pray, you see that they go to school, their madrasa, they learn the rules, but you see, still, even knowing all the rules, the enthusiasm for prayers is not there. The reason is because we have just taught them the rules. The spirit of the law is in the Seerat of the Prophet. It's in the Seerat of the Prophet. Just a little example I'll give you so you understand. You know the rules, but that encourage, that enthusiasm not there. Just if you tell someone a little thing from the Seerat of the Prophet, that, you know, when Rasulullah used to make ruku, he used to extend it. He used to extend that ruku. Just the fact that you hear that he used to extend that ruku now will incline you to do the same in your ruku. Just that little idea will make you want to do it because he used to do it. You see, this is the effect of Seerat. This is how it affects you. If you know that, then you see that it just affects you in that way. This is why we learn Seerat, so that the laws are there, we need to learn them, but the spirit of the laws, the rule, the enthusiasm behind the laws is learning the Seerat of the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt. This is why it's so important to know what they did, how they did, so that we can be inspired by them and do it in our own lives. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. Three years, the Prophet and his people were sieged in the farm of Abu Talib. And they came out of that through Allah's miracle that he had done. Now when they came back, obviously it was not the same as before. Because before they went there into this 3 years of boycott and embargo, there were two people who were the pillars behind the prophet. His uncle Abu Talib and his wife Khadija. And both of them died. Now that the prophet came back, he did not have neither his wife, nor did he have his uncle. And this was in the 10th year after the announcement of the prophethood, or you know, his becoming the prophet. So now he came back to Mecca, it was different. The fact was that his neighborhood that he lived in, his house on one side was the house of Abu Lahab, and the other side was the house of Utbah ibn Abu Ma'id. Now, when you look at these two people, they were enemies of the Prophet. And they used to make his life a living hell. You hear about the stories of the thorn and the trash that's thrown at the door. And there are other things also which, you know, really cannot even be mentioned on the minbar, or what they used to do. Now, with all the impurities and najasa, they used to desecrate his house. They used to throw trash and najasat in the food that is being made in his house. His life at home used to be so hard in just trying to have a decent life. I mean, there were so much indecent things that were being done to him. And on the other hand, when he used to leave his house for tabligh, and he used to go everywhere, now you see the people, because of the death of his uncle, were now encouraged, and now they were, they became more open about what they can do to him. In fact, you know, until now they did not, they were not physically harming him. But now, as he used to walk around, they used to spit on his face, they used to throw things at him, everywhere he used to walk. They would not let him talk, they would not let him do anything. And he knew that his life in Mecca was getting very hard. Two things, obviously, that need to be noted here. With the death of his uncle Abu Talib, Abu Lahab became the elder of the family. Now, as soon as he became the elder of the family, a realization came through him that, you know, the way of the Arabs of Jahiliyyah was that no matter what, your family is right. Meaning that you defend your family no matter what the situation is. Meaning that tribal asabiya, that tribalism that was inside of their hearts, rose up in him. And as he became the elder of the Bani Hashim, he realized that, listen, hey, I might not agree with my nephew, but he is still my family. He is still my family. And this realization came over Abu Lahab. And these atrocities that were happening to the Prophet for a short while were stopped by Abu Lahab. He came to his defense and he stopped those things from happening. And the kuffar, because the important thing to understand here is that those people who were against the Prophet, those tribes that were against the Prophet, were historical enemies of Bani Hashim. The only reason Abu Lahab was with them is because he also disagreed with Islam and the Prophet. But because he became the elder of the family, now he wanted to defend the Prophet. Not because he liked Islam or anything, but because he was a part of his tribe. And he started doing that. Now, one of the things here what happened is that the people who were around him and who were, you know, for example, even the Muslims who were there, now instead of being happy with what he was doing, they started to mock him and ridicule him. You know, and this usually happens amongst us also. You see, like anyone, for example, who was not practicing Islam. Let's say he didn't have a beard. And then, you know, for example, he started to keep a beard. Now what happened is that amongst mu'mineen, the way that they treat this issue is not by, for example, saying, Alhamdulillah, may Allah bless you, this and that. They say, aha, you see, we told you. All right? Before, now you came to your senses, right? And they start taunting him instead of actually trying to encourage him. And because of these taunting, because of this mockery, usually what happens, those people will say that, oh, well, if that's the case, the hell with this, I'm going to leave, you know? So they stop doing that. It happens amongst us also, instead of trying to encourage people, when you see them doing good, we will start to ridicule them, because for a long time we used to explain to them and give them hujjat and proof and ayat and hadith, and they never listened. So now that they listen, you see, aha, you see, I told you from before, right? And you were wrong all the time and I was right. And what happens is that it makes him go away and stop doing what he is doing. So the same thing happened with Abu Lahab. Abu Lahab, you know, slowly, for whatever reason, for his tribalistic views that he had of Jahiliyyah, was defending the Prophet. And because of that, there some people around him are saying, aha, you see, now you came to your senses. This and that. So these type of talks, again, made Abu Lahab go back. He said, all right, if that's the case, you know, I'm going to go back and I'm going to fight against my nephew. Again, he changed his attitude. That was one thing that happened. That Abu Lahab, again, for that short shift that he had in his attitude, changed right away. And now, with that in mind, and then the death of the Prophet's wife, which was a major blow to the Prophet, because of the fact that at least in his home there was comfort. The home there was comfort, and you need to realize that when his wife died, Hazrat Fatima was 5 years old. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So now he had a young girl in the house, and there's no mother in the house. There's no woman in the house. And that's the reason you see that right after the death of his wife, Khadija, there was this need right now, because of the fact that, you know, he cannot go out of his house to preach. His work was to go and do tabligh and call the people towards Islam. So that was not being done. So what he, right away, a month after she died, right away he got married again. Right? And the wife, who was the only wife after Khadija in Makkah, right? The only wife that he had in Makkah who came to his house, was by the name of Sauda ibn Binte Zam'a. And she was one of the early Muslims. She and her husband had migrated to Ethiopia. And either on the way back from Ethiopia or after they returned to Makkah, her husband died. She had a dream that she asked her husband about, in which she had said, or she saw clouds, dark clouds all over her, and then from those dark clouds appeared a bright moon. And she told her husband was dying, and he said, you know, and he was also an alim because he was sent to Ethiopia to preach Islam to the people there. And so he said that, you know, I think what this means is that after me, the only moon that exists that is bright in this whole region of Hijaz is the Prophet himself. And it so happened that when Khadija had died, then not because she died in the month of Ramadan, 1 month later in the month of Shawwal, you see that Rasulullah was married to Sauda binte Zam'a. And as this marriage happened, she was now like a mother to Fatima. In the time they were there together in Makkah for the next 3 years, right? She was the only wife of the Prophet. And now with this in mind, now you see the situation amongst the people of Makkah, the chiefs of Makkah, was that they looked at Abu Lahab, his shift that came in his attitude, and they became very scared because of that. Because they remembered Hamza, how he became a Muslim. And Abu Lahab had also told the kuffar that, listen, if you don't desist, I will become a Muslim also. So it was a threat to them, you know. So when he made that threat, they said, all right, you know what? This is going to get bad if he becomes a Muslim. Then we have no one amongst Bani Hashim who is going to be with us. So when that case happened, they did not do anything like that. But they said, we need to take this seriously and try to do whatever we can to stop the Prophet. The Prophet knew that he had no helpers in Makkah. And this is the reason for the next 2.5 years he was traveling. He was traveling now. He took the message out of Makkah and he was traveling to villages, to small towns and different areas. And it is in one of those travels was to Taif, the city of Taif. This is more known amongst the Muslims, this short trip that he had to Taif. And obviously it's emphasized, and you see that the Muslims want to point out, many of them want to point out that, you know what? They use the example of Taif because he went to Taif to preach there, and you know what happened there. I'm going to explain it also a little bit about what is this trip that he had to Taif, what handed. But it's used as an excuse to say that, you see, it was a mistake of the Prophet that he went to Taif. They use that as a mistake. We need to understand what is Taif so that we know how to understand the seerat of the Prophet, why he went to Taif. So we know what is the way of the Prophet. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Taif, even today, is like a hill station in the whole of Hijaz. The land is rolling hills, greenery, fertile land, lots of water, cool air. It's a hill station. It's like, for example, in all the area, region of Hijaz, if you are somebody, you will have a vacation home in Taif. It was a rich area, affluent area. People who were there were affluent. Taif, as is mentioned in the ayat of the Quran also, when the Prophet went with the message to the people, he says, "Lawla nuzzila hazal Quran ala rajulin min al qaryatayn azim." Why wasn't this Quran revealed on someone big or someone well known in the two cities, meaning Makkah and Taif? Why wasn't it revealed on someone well known in these two cities? Why was it revealed on you and nobody, an orphan? Right? And what they meant by these two people were who? In Makkah it was Walid, right? If you remember Walid ibn Mughira, right? And in Taif it was a person by the name of Urwa ibn Mas'ud. Who's this Urwa ibn Mas'ud? Urwa ibn Mas'ud is the grandfather of Umm Layla, the wife of Imam Hussein. And he was one of the first people who came to the Prophet from Taif. The first people who came to the Prophet, and he accepted Islam at the hands of the Prophet. And he told the Prophet that, allow me to go back to Taif and preach this to the people. Preach the religion to the people. We see he was not allowed to at first. He insisted. And so Rasulullah allowed him to go. He said before that, do not go. They're not ready yet for the message. He said, no, I want to go back, because he was regarded as a very noble man in Taif. So he went back there, and within 3 days they killed him. In 3 days they killed him. So he was the first martyr from Taif. But this region, this city, was a very well-known city, big city, right? And you know that if you want to go into a big city and do propagation of Islam, it's difficult. It's not easy because you have a lot of affluent people, influential people, you know, who would right away, you know, stomp you and make sure that you don't do anything that goes against their interest. Always is the case. So now what happened is that when the people who used to run Taif was a tribe by the name of Banu Saqifa, the tribe of Saqifa. This tribe is well known, and it used to run that place. Like, for example, the Quraysh used to run Makkah, Banu Saqifa used to run Taif. They used to be in charge of Taif, the big guns of Taif. And obviously there, I mean, amongst the known people from this tribe is Mukhtar. Mukhtar ibn Abi Saqafi is from the tribe of Bani Saqifa. He's from the tribe of Bani Saqifa. And Hajjaj ibn Yusuf. Right? So, one person who killed Ahlul Bayt and one person who killed the enemies of Ahlul Bayt. Right? Both of them came from the same tribe. Right? Both of them came from the same tribe. So now what happened is that these people used to run that place. And at the time the Prophet, he went there, you see, Rasulullah, he was, the reason he went there is because amongst the leaders, those who used to run the place, were three brothers. One of those brothers was married to his to the Prophet's cousin in Makkah. Because of that marriage, you see, the Prophet migrated. He went to Taif because of that relation, so that he can go there and preach to them. Obviously, it wasn't meant that he was going to go through every place. To him, the message of Allah needs to go everywhere, so he will not learn. He will not leave any stone unturned until he gives the message to everyone. Taif was next in the list. He went there, and because of that relationship, when he entered Taif, when he entered the place, you see that now these people were very hard-headed when it comes to idol worship. I want you to understand the people of Taif very well, right? Before I explain to you what happened to the Prophet. They're very hard-headed people. They were in charge of Lot. If you remember, if you know that in the house of Allah, there are three main idols: Lot, Manat, and Uzza. The people of Taif were in charge of Lot. That was their god. They used to take care of it, and they were so much attached to it that when Abraha came and his army came to wipe out the Kaaba, so Abraha's army got lost. They ended up in Taif. They didn't know how to find their way to Makkah. So when they got lost and they came to Taif, the people of Taif saw the hugeness of the army, how big the army was, and they went to the army and said, listen, right? We will show you the way to Makkah if you leave our God alone, Lot. If you leave Lot alone, right? Then we will, you can do what you want. To Makkah. And so they agreed with that. So these people showed them the way to Makkah. Right? How to get to Makkah. And yeah, after that, the Meccans obviously were upset at those people. But then everything worked out after that, the next generation. But what happened is that you see that these people sold out Makkah in order to save their god Lot. In fact, they were so hard-headed that they were the last city in the whole of the Arab world to become Muslim. They were the last city to become Muslim. And when Islam was everywhere in Hijaz, and all of Hijaz became Muslim, this was the only city that refused to do that. And then when they finally wanted to accept Islam, they made conditions. They said, we will accept Islam with three conditions. They said, we will accept Islam, but with three conditions, because they saw everyone is a Muslim now. They said, we'll accept Islam with three conditions. One, leave Lot alone. That was one condition. Two, that allow us not to pray for 3 years. Right? You give us a discount because they're rich, affluent people. They said, you know, 3 years of no prayers. Right? If they had only known that even after you become Muslim, how many Muslims don't pray? They wouldn't have made that condition. Right? So they said, you know that, 3 years of no prayer, and number three, we want wine and we want to gamble. These two things allow it for us. If you do these things for us, we'll accept Muslims. I mean, imagine this. It's not at the beginning. This is when Islam was everywhere now. And then after that, they're making these three conditions. So you see, these people were very hard-headed and staunch about their beliefs in their idol. Very staunch. So when the Prophet went there, he went straight to the house of the elders, those people who were in charge. The house was big, the door was open because everyone used to come in and out because they were the leaders of Taif. He entered the hall. As he entered the hall, the chief of Taif saw the Prophet from afar. His other two brothers were sitting with him. And he looked at the Prophet. He said, oh, look at this, what has come here. The person who is leading astray the people in Makkah has come here to lead the people astray here. And this is right when the Prophet is entering the house. My friends, imagine this, you know, I mean, this sort of statements when you're going there to preach, right? How would that make you feel right away? You know, I mean, if anything less than that was said to us while we are preaching, we'll be like, you know what, the hell with it? Let me go back. Let me go somewhere else. I had enough of this. You know, little things. But you see, he was said that, but he didn't stop. He didn't even break in his step. He just kept on walking. He came up to them. The other brother said, you know, if you are truly a prophet, then I promise I will go and break the Kaaba and burn its cloth. I don't think you're a prophet. Then the third brother, he said that, you know, if you are truly the prophet of God, then you would be so honored that we should not speak to you. Because you will be so big and honorable. And if you are a liar, then we shouldn't speak to you anyway. So in either cases, we don't want to talk to you. Because if you are the messenger of God, you're too honorable to be talked to. So go on. And if you're a liar, then we shouldn't be talking to you anyway. So both these things, again, you see, the Prophet is hearing these words. And then he said, all right, no, it's all right. He didn't stop. He gave them the message. He went out and gave the people the message. Started to give the people the message. The youth, obviously, in any propagation, you see it's always the poor and the youth who start coming around first. Right away, the youth came around him. The poor came around him. They were listening to what he's saying. It made sense. It made sense. And they started listening. And they were getting close to him. And right away, the chiefs realized, hey, you know what? This is enough. We need to do something about this, otherwise he's going to stick here for another 10 years like he's stuck in Makkah. And we don't want him to stay here for 10 years. We want to get him out in 10 days. So it is said that the Prophet was in Taif for from 1 week to 3 weeks between this time. This is the time he was in Taif. And then they got the youth and the slaves together. And they said, listen, he's a magician and a madman. What you need to do with him, and we allow you as elders. And obviously, if the parents allow their children to throw stones, hey, the children have no problem with that. Right? The only reason they don't throw stones is because their parents don't allow them. But if the parents say, hey, listen, beat him up with stones, the kids will be happy to do that. So the parents got together. Everyone said, beat him up with stones. Whatever you can find, throw at him and get him out of town. The slaves and the youth, all of them got together and they started to, wherever they see that, it wasn't a big, you know, like for example, a lot of places, they started hitting him wherever they saw him. Everyone in groups, they came and started hitting him with stones. And he was, you know, bleeding from different places. Stones were hitting. They would not even allow him to bow down to tie his shoes or to rectify his shoes or his pants. Anytime he would bow down, they would come and push him with their hands so he falls down. And then they would start hitting him again. They hit him so much, like the scene was like that, like how you would get rid of an animal. How you would get rid of an animal, that's how they hit the prophet to get rid of him from Tyre. Imagine that, my friend. That's how they hit him. Until he crossed the limits of the city. When he crossed the limits of the city, that is where they stopped. They know that this is their jurisdiction, not to go beyond the city limits. As he crossed the city limits, he went there to a farm. And he found a shade under a grape tree. It was a farm of Utba and Sheba. They were the elders of the town, rich people of the town. He found a shade underneath there. And in that shade, he sat over there. And there he made a dua. I don't have the time to go into that dua. Very well-known dua that he read. That Allah, you know, remove my weakness and give me strength to bear this. And so on and so forth. He made that dua to Allah. As he made that dua to Allah under the shade of that tree, the Arabs, it was their way that, you know what, no matter who it is, if it's an enemy also, if he's a guest, you serve them something. So Utba and Shayba, they told their servant, their slave, a Christian slave by the name of Adash, they told him to go and give him a drink. So he took the drink there in a platter. He went to the prophet. He offered him the drink. The prophet accepted the drink and said, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, and started drinking. The slave was shocked and said, what did you say? He said, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. He said, no, because everyone over here, they say, you know, Bismillah, right? They start with the name of Lat. This is new what I'm hearing. What is this, you know? So the prophet, he said, where are you from? You're not from here. He said, I am from Nineveh. From Nineveh. So then Rasulullah said, oh, the land of my brother, Nineveh. And so the slave was like, your brother is from Nineveh? Who's your brother there in Nineveh? And he said, Prophet Yunus. All the Anbiya, they refer to themselves as brothers. He says, Prophet Yunus is there. And then he said, but, you know, he said, I know Nineveh, and very few people in Nineveh know about Prophet Yunus, and no one outside knows about Prophet. How do you know about Prophet Yunus? Then he started explaining. He said, I am a prophet also. Allah sent me. This is what he said. Then he started asking him. As he was drinking water, he started asking him. And you see that just few minutes had passed. And he said that I want to accept the religion that you have brought. I want to accept the religion you brought. He accepted it. And then he came back. And the prophet left. He came back inside. And they were looking at him, because the fact is that when he accepted him, he started to kiss his feet. He started to kiss the feet of the prophet, right? To say that, you know, I am so glad to meet you. You know, I didn't know what would happen to me here, but now I know why I came here for. He accepted Islam. And then when he came back inside, Utba and Shayba looked at him and said, you know, you are our slaves. You never kissed our feet. Why are you kissing his feet? He says, because he told me the truth. He's a magician. Don't listen to his words. You'll be lost. You'll go astray. He said, no. I know what is right when I see it. And this man is right. This is the truth. My friends, the prophet, no one in Taif listened to him amongst those who are rich. But that whole journey, even if it was that one slave that he made a Muslim there. One person. The prophet went through that stoning so that that one person can get the message. You see, my friends, this is the prophet. This is the way of the prophet. Doesn't matter how much he has to go through, but that one person must get the message. Those people should get the message. Really, if you look at that, then you can understand that what did the prophet go to give that message to that one person so he might get it. Not at all concerned with Taif, a slave, a servant, no one important. And if you look at that example, then you will understand that for Zainab and Imam Zainul Abidin to go through what they did, the hardships that they did, who was that message for? Who were they taking the message for? Who were they taking this message for? This message, my friends, was it meant for Yazid? Yazid was not going to get the message. This message was meant for mu'mineen like you and me. How much they went through in order to give us the message. How many lashes did Imam Zainul Abidin took on himself? How many bruises did Zainab and Sakina took on themselves in order to bring the message of Hussein to those who are going to believe in that message? Just imagine it, my friends. What did they go through? They went through all that, but you know, if the message has been given to us, this is the accomplishment of their mission. If today you are shedding tears for Hussein and for the movement of Hussein and the mission of Hussein, then Zainab has accomplished what she set out for. Imam Sajjad has accomplished what he set out for. Zainab, when she went through this, all the children who went through that, my friends, you know how hard was it for the mothers who had children with them? Many mothers who had children with them. If you go, if most people who go on the trip for ziyarat, and you go for the long trip of the ziyarat, where they go through all the maqamat and all the places and holy places, you will see amongst those trip is a trip that goes from all the way from Karbala to Sham. And in that trip, they stop at these small places on the way to make ziyarat at these little graves that are in the way. You know what those little graves are? These were the babies of those mothers. These mothers used to have babies, and because their hands were tied on their head and they were sitting on camels, the babies were put in their laps. Those children, those toddlers, they used to sit in the laps of the mothers. But as the camels were being raced, now those children could not handle themselves on those laps. They would start to fall down. They would lose their control and balance. And they would call out to their mother that, "Mother, help me, I'm falling down." They would hold on to the mother's lap and they would hold on to the shirt. The mother would look at the eyes of the child looking up in fear to the mother, and that mother will look in hopelessness and helplessness at the child with tears streaming down, and in that moment of grief, that child would fall from the camel, and as he would fall from the camel, the mother would see him trampled by the other camels that are coming from behind. That love that she had for a child would pour out, and she would cry for that. It is said in many of the riwayat, we see that it is said that Zahra, Fatimah al-Zahra, when she went with the caravan, that she used to cry for each and every child who used to fall down and become a shaheed. And Fatima used to cry over them, and she used to do matam over them. Today, if we give our salam to Ahlul Bayt, that they went through these hardships to bring us our message. Assalamu alaikum ya Rabbi. سيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون يا محمود بحق محمد يا علاء بحق علي يا فاطر السماوات بحق فاطمة يا محسن بحق حسن يا قديم الأحسان بحق حسين. Oh Allah, give us the tawfiq to be on the right path. Give us the wisdom to understand your guidance. Hasten the reappearance of our Imam. Make us his helper when he comes. وآخر دعوانا الحمد لله رب العالمين.